This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's my honor and privilege to introduce Georgiana Valois Sanchez, my tribal sister who lives down south, but whose family is actually from very nearby, and I'll show you that later when I'm into my slides. Born and raised in Southern California, Georgiana Valois Sanchez is Native American of both the Chumash and the Autumn peoples. She is an elder on the Governing Council of the Barbarino Chumash Council, the chair of the Chumash Elders Women's Council of the Wishtoyo Foundation as well. She has taught for the American Indian Studies program at California State University, Long Beach, for over 26 years, teaching American Indian philosophies, American Indian literature, California Indian history, pre-1871 history, and ethnic experience in the United States. Her writings have appeared in several national and international publications. She is a renowned storyteller and board member of the California Indian Storytellers Association, and co-founder of the League of Indigenous Voices in Story and Song. She continues to be a dedicated advocate for the preservation of indigenous languages, sacred sites, ceremonial practices, and traditional arts. Welcome, Georgie.
I used to bring my dad's walking stick. He was born in 1897 for ceremony, and this is ceremony, but it really helps me to get around now as I become an elder. Before I introduce our speakers, I wanted to really make mention of Micah McCarty, who was unable to be here. He was the convener of the first Stewards Symposium, and we'd like to recognize all the work that he has done on indigenous issues and sea level rise, and we're very, very grateful and sorry that he couldn't make it. And Ben, you did a great job. I'm so proud of you. I always end up being everybody's auntie. Yeah, everybody's auntie and everybody's grandma, so I'm very proud of you. Our first speaker will be Roberta Reyes Cordero from the coastal Chumash of Santa Barbara. Roberta has been a professional peacemaker since 1987, specializing in cross-cultural, large group, and family mediation. In 1995-96, with a small group of local Chumash people in Santa Barbara, she co-founded the Chumash Maritime Association, a nonprofit group seeking to revitalize indigenous maritime heritage. She is currently involved in a special project with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and NOAA. In this project, she is working with coastal indigenous communities to characterize tribal cultural landscapes for resource protection, as well as to develop protocols for tribal consultation in response to proposed projects such as ocean energy development. And we need that voice. Our next presenter is going to be Kalei Nuuhiwa. Researcher and curriculum developer and first stewards witness. Kalei was born and raised in Maui, Hawaii, one of my favorite places in the world. Her primary discipline is papahulilani, the study of all aspects of the atmosphere. In traditional Hawaiian worldview, these atmospheric elements embody the pantheon of Kino Akua Hawaii and provide a fundamental function in ancestral memory, still essential in the modern Hawaiian consciousness. And that just really intrigues me. I just love that. She maintains ongoing studies of celestial alignments with sites situated in the Northwest and main Hawaiian islands to understand traditional tracking of time and spatial measurements. Wow. I like it. Our next speaker is going to be Michael Williams, who I have been sitting next to, and I just already have such respect and such affection for this man. He is with the Yupik, chief of the Yupik Nation. Michael Williams is from the small village of Akiak on the lower Kuskokwim River in western Alaska. Mike graduated from the Chemehua Indian School in Salem, Oregon, and served in South Korea as a member of the U.S. Army. In July 2012, Williams presented testimony from his community's experience with erosion and permafrost melt at the First Stewards Symposium, where he served as the Alaska panel moderator for the Alaska delegation. He currently works as a wellness counselor for his village and is also an avid Iditarod trail sled dog race competitor, and I saw some pictures. Really, really love that. I think we've got all our people. So we're going to begin, I believe, with Roberta. Right? Where are you? Good. Okay, excellent. Thank you.
If I can find the front of this, I'll be doing good here. Okay. I'm calling my presentation the Chumash Cultural Landscape of Goleta Slough. The cultural landscape approach looks at a landscape holistically. It includes the people and the effects of their interactions with the environment. We can also see that the environment affects the people, directly forming culture, or my favorite definition for culture, how we do things around here. Right? And that applies to all levels of culture that we exist in. I hope that this presentation will give you a sense of this landscape where we are meeting, both over time and currently, as it is always important to know where we are and how things work or used to work here. In the time-honored style of the time-honored way of storytelling, this story is meant to be thought-provoking without actually explicating the lessons. You will have to take those for yourself, and they will be different for each of you, I'm sure. Our families and stories tell us that since time immemorial, we have been here. We have always been here. The archaeological record so far says that Chumash ancestors were already here 13,000 or more years ago. That's a really long time ago. It's before pyramids, it was before the Chinese Empire. I mean, you know, it's a long time ago. In this thumbnail sketch of looking at the geological overview first and then in a little bit more specifically the Chumash cultural overview, we see that at the end of the Pleistocene glacial melt, 120 meters or 393 plus feet overall was added to the volume of the ocean between 17,000 and 6,000 years ago. And we know that offshore from the mouth of Goleta Slough, which is very near to here, the old shoreline is about 200 feet underwater, 200 feet off the coast there. Before European contact, an extensive series of wetlands surrounded the present areas of UCSB and Isla Vista and included Goleta and Devereaux Sloughs and UCSB Lagoon. So the Chumash ancestors were actually already here during that glacial melt, and they saw villages inundated over time. Did they carry the memory of that in their stories? We believe that they did. They witnessed and were affected by inundation of their coastal villages, and those events were memorialized. This slide shows a map of Chumash villages pre-contact. Let's see if I can point out a few things to you. It's kind of stretched out here, but excuse me. Here is Sirtun, which you know as Santa Barbara. And here we are, I think that's, I can't quite see the lettering, but this is where we're talking about here. I believe that's correct. Point Conception out here somewhere. And the territory extended down to at least Malibu Rock, and at least up to Morro Bay Rock, Morro Rock, and included the Northern Channel Islands, all of San Luis Obispo, Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties, and parts of Kern and LA counties. It's a very extensive area. Now, just up the coast, if I can point it out. Whoops, sorry. Just a little bit west here is where Georgie and her brother Johnny's family are from, the villages of Miquiu and Cuyamo that we know as Dos Pueblos. You see here a concentration on the coast of villages, and that's because of the many perennial creeks, which no longer exist as perennial creeks because of the kind of damming and changing of the water holders that happened early on after European contact. But that was because those perennial creeks contributed to wetlands at the coast, creating really abundant resources in very specific places. I want to highlight aspects of Chumash ancestral culture here. At the time of pre-contact, this was a lagoon. And for many thousands of years before that, it had been a lagoon, not a slough. It was a regional tomol, or canoe harbor, and major trade center. It was a key part of what Lynn Gamble calls the socio-politically complex Chumash network strategy developed to cope with variable ecological and climatic conditions. Those were the ways that we worked together to survive and to change when we needed to. The population in the Goleta Slough area that we now know as that area numbered about 2,000, and it was spread over several villages, such as Gila, which was on the island of Mescalitan Island, and Alcashash, I'm not exactly sure where that was, I'll try and spot it another time, Heliuk, which is right at UCSB campus on the mesa here, and Saaxpilil. Gila was on Mescalitan Island, and it was continuously occupied for thousands of years. And we know that there was a burial of a beloved woman that was excavated in the 1800s, and there were hundreds of pounds of shell bead money that was found in this burial. The presence of that much shell bead money indicated both her high standing and the wealth of the village. And it was also a practice that is believed to have been a means to avoid inflation of the money system, which was very complex and well established. From the name of Mescalitan Island, it comes from Mescaltitlan, and it was named by a 1760 expedition of Spanish soldiers, most of whom were indigenous Mexican people. They named it for Mescaltitlan Lagoon in Nayarit, Mexico. In Nahuatl, that refers to the Aztec heartland, a place where Mother Earth resided on an island in a lagoon. That lagoon was deep enough for post-contact ships to anchor until at least 1800, so it was a very, very nice harbor area. In 1769, Fray Juan Crespi was on an expedition also for the Spanish, and he said that just in Hilo, on Mescalitan Island, that one village, that there were more than 100 large houses, not less than 800 individuals, and 16 canoes. And we know that there were two freshwater springs on that island that supported that population over time. This is a map that was made by Philip Orr in 1943. He was an anthropologist that was associated with the Santa Barbara Natural History Museum. The dark areas represent villages, so you can see. Oops, I keep doing the wrong button, sorry about that. You can see here is Mescalitan Island with Hilo. Over here is Heliuk, and I'm not sure what the names of the other villages were, but I know that over here somewhere along Mor Mesa, there's a place that was called Wokwoko, and that's because there was so much asphaltum there. Woko means asphaltum in Chumash, and it was a very important building material, a material that we used for glue and other things. And Wokwoko, in the way of the Chumash language, where you just duplicate part of the word, means a whole lot of woko, and it's still there. And I want to distinguish that from the soft beach tar that we find, too. It's a different stage of that particular petroleum product. Here we see Goleta Point, which I think we refer to as Campus Point in these days. The people comprised highly sophisticated sedentary gatherer-hunter societies made possible by the lavish local natural resources and complex trade networks. They also had well-developed local governance with accountable leaders, both men and women. That sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? There was an overlay of regional and provincial governance, and this is how those really complex networks were formed and maintained. It is estimated that only 20 hours or so of subsistence labor were required for each person to survive and really thrive. I really like that idea a lot. So we came up with some of the best basket weavers in California, if not the best. Pomo might say something differently, but I think it was Chumash. Lots of storykeepers, many kinds of medicine people, astronomers who really had very sophisticated knowledge of the skies, religious and artisanal societies, and so on. It was very, very sophisticated. Had lots of times to just hang out. The current archaeology, as I mentioned before, dates ancestral Chumash presence in this region overall to 13,000 or more years ago. But I want you to keep in mind that our stories tell us about when the animals were still people, about the natural world and how we were supposed to behave. And they take place in actual localities and sometimes in crystal houses under the sea. This story is taken from two stories that are reported in December's Child, and they came to us through our ancestors, Juan de Jesus Justo and Luisa Ignacio, a survival story of how Coyote rescues Hedek from the El Iwun, the swordfish people. It takes place in a coastal Chumash village. And the cast of characters include the village Wot, or Slo, you might know him as Golden Eagle, and along with 12 men and women of his Antaper council, he governs this village and maybe one or two neighboring villages as well. In this story, we will meet three Tomo captains. This is Helek, Peregrine Falcon. He's Slo's nephew. And all of these three captains or skippers are excellent fishers as well. And Peregrine Falcon, we regard as the medicine for the Tomos and the captains and the crews, even still. We'll see their tomos. This is the Tomo Helek. Here is a second captain, Hugh. You know him as Brown Pelican. We all know what a good fisher he is. And here's another Tomo. This is Eliotwun. And Mut, another skipper, we know as Cormorant. And he's a very deep diver. He gets those fish that he has to swim for underwater. And another Tomo, this is Muptmai. So we're going to see what happens to them as they go deep. This is a white sea bass. And the picture that we saw before is Pacific mackerel. White sea bass like those a lot. We like these a lot too, but white sea bass is delicious. And here is the villain of the piece, Eliotwun. He comes from the people of the sea, swordfish. And last but not least, the hero of the piece, Shipshewash, Coyote, when the animals were still people. Long ago, when the animals were still people, the Tomo captain Helek went fishing in the ocean with Mut and Hugh, who were also Tomo skippers. From his Tomo, he saw a big white sea bass, so he threw his harpoon at it because it was really big. But just as he released the harpoon, he slipped and fell into the water and was grabbed by a huge Eliotwun. The Eliotwun carried Helek away so quickly that when Hugh and Mutt looked and waited for him to surface, they just couldn't find him. Finally, they had to head back to the village before it got too dark to take their bearings from the mountains. When Slo saw that his nephew Helek had not returned with the other two, he questioned Hugh and Mutt very closely, intending to send them after Helek. But Coyote, who was standing nearby, said, "Forget it! He won't come back because they have kidnapped him." Slo said, "What are you talking about, Shipishewash? You're making up one of your stories." Coyote said, "Hey, it's no story. There are people who live in crystal houses in a village under the sea, just off the shore here, just as there are people here. That's where these swordfish people have taken Helek." Of course, Slo was very worried about this, but he knew that Coyote was a very clever man, and so he selected Coyote to do the rescue, finally having to command him to go when Coyote protested loudly, as he always did. So the next day, Hugh and Mutt paddled Coyote out to the area where they had lost Helek overboard and agreed to meet back there in 6 days, hopefully with Helek. Armed with a case full of pespibata, which is a special tobacco mixture, a bag full of poisonous toadstool powder, and his bow and arrows, Coyote plunged in. He swam to the bottom, where he walked around slowly, looking all around him until he found the house of the El Eliotun. When he found their door, he gave it some tobacco. Now, the door really liked that tobacco, so it opened wide, and in Coyote went. There he found a very old swordfish man. He also found Helek all wrapped up and hanging from the rafters of the house, apparently dead. He could see that the other swordfish were out hunting for the day, so he began negotiating with the old man to revive Helek and return him to Coyote. The negotiations, which is just a polite way to say that a whole lot of trickery, deception, and magic was happening on both sides, went on and back and forth for several days. Coyote would first bribe the old man with his tasty pespibata, but then he'd blow poison powder over him to overpower him and make him sick, really sick. The hunters returned at the end of each day, a whale slung over the shoulders of each man. Each night, they would feast gluttonously and dance wildly almost through the night until Coyote was so exhausted he would have to eat his pespibata just to stay alert. Eventually, the El Eliotun forced him to go out whale hunting with them as a condition for Helek's release, and with his pespibata, he was able to keep up with them. Coyote also had to win a foot race with them, which he did, using the time-honored coyote method, accomplished by setting out poop decoy coyotes in relay so he could hide at the finish line. In the end, he had to overpower all of them with his magic powder before they would relent. In exasperation, the old man swordfish convinced the others that Coyote would never leave them in peace if they didn't revive Helek and release him. So finally, they did this. Indeed, they were so glad to get rid of Coyote and his magic powder that the kidnapper even showed him the way back to where Helek had fallen overboard so they could meet the other captains. Three tomos were there to take them home, and everyone, especially Slo, the what, was so happy and relieved to have Helek and Shipishewash return home safely. Here they have their canoes in harbor. They doctored Helek until he was his old self and could go fishing again. And Slo regarded Coyote richly. Sutiwayan ul atuk. So goes the story. That's how they tell it. Okay, so now we've covered about 13,000 years. Let's just look at a couple of centuries. As I said before, at the time of first European contact, this area was a lagoon and a harbor. But let me just tell you a little bit about what happened to change it into a slough. In 1849, the gold rush led to a very big demand for beef, and so therefore to an increase in the large local cattle ranches, and then to overgrazing and erosion. Followed by, guess what? What always happens here after that? You get a fire, and then you get a flood, right? We know this. In this case, a lot of floods, pretty big floods, and really incredible amounts of sedimentation happening in the lagoon, which changed it to a slough. And then in the late 1800s, roads and dikes crisscrossed the area. Into the 20th century, we saw a landing strip get built here, 1942 to 1943, that became a Marine Corps air station, well, also an Army base up here, which became Santa Barbara Airport. Much of Mescalitan Island and UCSB were removed for fill, removing all kinds of archaeological material from those villages. They just got mowed into the landfill. We see ongoing urbanization with wastewater treatment plant, major creeks flowing in that bring all kinds of pollutants with them that you can see. I've listed up here. It's pretty bad. We can't use the native plants very much anymore. Now I'm going to take you just on a quick aerial tour of what happened to Goleta Slough, and I want to show you where Mescalitan Island is in each of these, just so you can keep track. Here you see there's a lot of farms, 1929. I wish that these were uniform maps, but they're not. They didn't plan this ahead for me, unfortunately. Mescalitan Island, still intact, 1938. More intensive farming. And then in 1942, a Japanese U-boat lobbed a shell onto the land. There was no explosion, but there was, of course, an immediate reaction. And the response was that an army base was built. Did I get the right one? And you can see it's still under construction. And Mescalitan Island is still... they've started to use parts of it here, so it's decreasing. 1954, here it is. We see mostly farmland, except there's some army buildings. You can see the campus in Isla Vista here. Here's Mescalitan Island, still pretty good, but changing. And now we see that a lot of the farms up here have become subdivisions. Here we are again, 1986, 1997. The sewage plant is visible next to Mescalitan. See if I can point that out for you. I think it's right up here. 1998, a little clearer. See if I can find it again. I think it's right around over here somewhere. When you come off the highway to come to the campus, you go right past that island. There's just a little piece of it left. Here you can see a better picture of it right here. But you can see, so this is the sewage treatment plant, and this island used to extend all around here. So what we have left in the 21st century is a remnant. This formerly was 1,150 acres. Currently, there are only 100 acres of salt marsh, 200 acres of vernal wetlands, and totaling about 50 acres, smaller segments, salt flats, mud flats, and streamside environments. So it's greatly, greatly changed. But still very beautiful in places. This is looking north towards the San Ynez Mountains. And this is looking east towards Schuftun, Santa Barbara. And I want to just show you very quickly how we don't live here anymore in this area, on these, not in the villages. And the plants have greatly changed. The resources are no longer available in large part. But we are still crafting many of the items that our Chumash ancestors were able to make when they lived here. And I'm just going to show you what some of them are without going into details. So these would have been either built here or traded for here. So we have 5 active tomals now, which is really wonderful. That is a change just in the last 15 years. It's a big change. This is something we would have traded for. This is a beautiful effigy. It's only about this big, but it's just absolutely beautiful. We haven't seen this kind of craftsmanship in a long, long time. These are things that people would have made. Everybody would have made things like this. This is a new traditional rattle. It's made from seaweed. The other things have a deeper tradition. This is probably at Lake Los Carneros, gathering tule, and I love these little dolls that were made there. We made our houses. This is a very small example of a tule house, an op. And we say op, op when we mean a lot of houses. These are at a village site at Nicholas Canyon near Malibu, and this is developed and run by Wishtoyo Foundation. Also made tule boats and mats, all kinds of things. It's a wonderful material. Now we're moving to Juncus, another wetlands important resource. These are three different styles of hats. They're probably all made by Tima Link here. Whoops. This young woman here who's become a really expert basket weaver. She's just doing marvelous things. There's a closer picture. There's Tima again. And this basket is our pride and joy in Chumash. We haven't seen a basket like this in 200 years of this quality and size. It's probably about this big. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And it also has, interestingly, some mission period elements with a prayer woven into the basket itself. And yes, we still eat acorns. Delicious stuff, very nutritious, more so than even tofu. And probably much more readily available if a lot of people knew how to do it, right? So, hurrah, it continues indefinitely. It continues. Thank you.
Ona kua I hanau I ka poikalai ki ku e a mai ke kaimai. Ona li I hanau I ka poikalai ki ku e a mai ke kaimai. Ona kanaka o kalahui I hanau I ka poikala e a mai ke kaimai. E ku e ola a ka kua pau. I greet you all with a real significant a chant that is actually in response to our Chumash brothers and sisters who welcomed us today, this morning. It basically talks about us all coming from the ocean and being of the same salt and being of the same land and knowing of each other. And so I acknowledge all of you that are sitting here today who come to listen to us, but I especially acknowledge those who are ancestral, a part of this land, and still are rooted here today in these days and times. Mahalo, aloha kako. Okay, so I have to preface my presentation with an apology. I was also affected by climate change coming here from Hawaii. There was a massive storm outside of San Francisco, and it didn't affect the plane that I was actually arriving upon, but the next one to get here to Santa Barbara, something about the altimeter, and if you don't have that, you don't know if you're up or down, which means so it doesn't bode well. So I only had about 4 hours of sleep. So if the neurons don't fire off, my daughter is tasked to help me lower my kite, so I stay on task. Anyway, I'm here as a representative for, as a witness who participated in the first Stewart's conference that happened in D.C. last year. And there were actually four of us. There were four witnesses. We were all invited to come and participate. There were various peoples from different nations, from the East Coast of here, Turtle Island, and also from the West Coast, Alaska, and a large contingency from the Pacific. There were various Pacific Islanders from as far north as the Hawaiian Islands to as far south as the Western Samoa Islands and the Samoan Islands, and as far west as the Sinai or the Micronesian Islands that are up there. We all came together and we're all talking about the same thing, which is what's happening to our lands and our islands. So I would like to start off. I started off my conversation back in D.C. about a kilo. So everybody say kilo. Okay, and a kilo is someone who witnesses change. And we are all here as part of witnesses to change that is happening to us today. And I'm hoping I get this right. Does this go right? Okay. So the word kilo itself has many meanings in the Hawaiian culture. And the first is, as you see here, it means a stargazer, reader of omens, seer, astrologer, even a necromancer. Okay, very important. And why that's important is that means that someone was tasked, or many people were tasked, to be the witnesses to mark the different things that were happening in order to align them with what's happening in the seasons brought about by the stars, the sun, and the moon. And of course, that happened over time. Kilo also means to look earnestly, means to pay attention, means to understand what's happening, to prognosticate what's about to occur, because you have enough empirical data, right? Data that you've collected over time through all of these witnesses, you know, through experience, changing your methodology, adapting to that change, and being able to predict what the seasons are about to occur, what happened in the past, and what is about to happen in the future, okay? To which you become an expert, okay? And finally, you get well enough in your practice, you're an expert enough that you can predict the future, and you can also do that by understanding what birds are doing, the barking of dogs, the different activities of the plants, the animals, and people. Okay, so are we all on the same page here? Oh, I think we are. Sounds familiar, yes? Okay. These are our natural indicators, and which brings me to us. Okay, these are the four witnesses that got to witness climate change. Of course, I know that I sit amongst many of you who are actually currently participating in that as well. Okay, whether you want to or not. The person on your left, that's Nelson Canuck, and Nelson is a very young but inspirational gentleman. He's a student from the Kipnuk, Alaska area, and he was the witness that helped gather all of the information for Alaska and the northern parts of our Americas. There's me, okay, Kalei Nu'uhiwa from Hawaii, talking about Pacific. We have the our doctoral candidate, Clarita Left-Hand Bagay, and she is a Navajo woman, and she's also residing currently in Washington. And the gentleman on your furthest right there, that is Ted Herrera, and he is a spiritual leader of the Tap-Pilam Quahulatikin Nation of Texas. So we represented a large body of people, and we had to sit and listen to everyone's experiences on how they adapted to change, because really that's the message. How are we going to adapt? Because climate change is happening. It's real. And one of the things that that stood out for us as the witnesses is we noticed that everyone sort of had the same theme, you know, that, I'll get into that in a little bit, so we don't get ahead of yourself, Kalei. Okay, what I want to say, though, is that one of the main things that we notice is that we're all survivors, every single one of us. We sit here, we've survived many different changes and challenges, and there are indicators, natural indicators, that help us continue to be so. One of the things that was very prominent in many of the things that were being discussed is that we are the litmus papers, the litmus paper, the people who don't have a choice. We still live with our environment. We cannot help it. We still rely upon the natural ecosystems. We rely on the cycles of certain animals, fish or plants, in order to survive. It's not a choice. So therefore, we are the natural indicator. When something is happening, we are the first to be impacted by it. And therefore, we are the first to try and figure out how we're going to adapt to that change, or not at all. It depends. And if you don't, you're no longer a survivor. Okay. Another thing that was a theme is that many people talked about how our lands and our practices define who we are as a people. Who we are as a people is not a choice. In Hawaii, you know, our diet is impacted. We don't have water anymore to continue eating our taro, which is our staple food. Fish are not around anymore. They're being overgrazed. They're overfished. So we're forced to eat at McDonald's, if you know, or be, you know, our water sovereignty is not there anymore. Our water security is not there anymore. Food security is not there anymore, so we're forced to adapt, but not that we want to, we have to. Okay, anyway. Together, the four of us put together a paper, and you're more than welcome to get our table. Which I think I sent on the Dropbox. I don't know if that's available to everyone. And what we did is put together, amalgamated everything that everyone said and put it together and tried to put them in different categories. We listed problems. We listed sometimes a certain tribe would be able to discuss about a problem and then thank you very much. And then would another tribe would talk about the solution. Okay. So I'm going to... We're still connected to the environment, as I was saying earlier. We still need to hunt. We still need to gather. Therefore, we are the empirical data. We are the ones who can provide knowledge to those who are policymakers. Okay. We have spent significant time on the lands that we reside upon, multiple generations, which means we are Noho Papa. We come from a certain place for many, many, many generations, have observed changes over many, many generation. So we are able to give knowledge that might help with solutions on how we can survive the change that is about to occur. One of the things is adaptive methodologies, empirical data to survive. Again, we have that knowledge. We need to share it. We are the litmus paper for health and the well-being of our lands. TEK found in our stories and chants are indicators on how we can prepare and survive the change. We have to recognize that there are differences. For example, in the East Coast, they're a little more proactive in how they've accepted that there are changes. Therefore, they're already proactive of how they're going to deal with that. The West Coast, on the other hand, those folks are being inundated by water, by ocean, by the relocation of their people, their families, their populations, all of that. And so they're being impacted profoundly and therefore are dealing with it. It's not a proactive thing. It's what am I going to do? Alaska, on the other hand, what happens to them? You'll get to hear that from Mike. And theirs is actually, to me, the most vivid story to tell about how they're being impacted, their communities are being impacted. And finally, us Pacific Islanders, most of us, you know, we're not afraid of the ocean. We've got stories where we've sailed. In fact, we have stories that we've come here. Hilo, for example. Where did she go? Yeah, that's one of our navigators. So, hey, we populated you guys. You didn't know that. Okay. We have Maui. We've been all over. We've had Kualii who came in the 15th century. You know, we've got no problems with the ocean inundating us, although it is a problem. However, historically, we'll get on a canoe and sail. So we're not really afraid of it. We're a little more lax. Relaxed about how we're going to deal with that. And it usually has to do with the tourist industry, right? Not necessarily with the indigenous people. Okay, so finally, and you know, it's hard to say everything in 15 minutes. I just want you guys to know that. Whew. Okay, so I'm going to end with something called small kid time. This is something that we do in Hawaii, and I'll try and wrap this up in 2 minutes because I know that's all I have. And what small kid time is it's for, so it's just an exercise for all of us right now at this moment. And what I'd like you to do is to sit and think about when you were a little child. Okay? Sit there and talk about it. If you can close your eyes if you want to. And kind of rewind the tape back to when you were a little person. Okay? Just a little kid. So I'll just stop talking while you think about that for a little bit. And all of our experiences are a little different. Some of us have memories of running through the forest. Others have memories of running through the beach or playing with our grandparents or having interaction with our siblings. It's a free time, right? It's a time when we're all allowed to be who we need to be. It's usually got to do with being able to fish however you want to fish, being able to gather however it is you want to gather, being able to just be free on lands that are clean and healthy and sustainable, yes? Some of you might have memories of being small kid, you know, in the city or in a town or a developed area, but it was a free time and it was a safe time. Am I correct? Okay, it's really hard to get away from that, right? Once we think about it, okay, so here we are as a people today with climate change about to occur, occurring, okay, to us right now. All we ask, right, all we want is that our children and our children's children be able to have that gift of being free, happy, and carefree. Yes? Okay, then let's do something about it. Mahalo.
Good morning. My name is Mike Williams. I'm from Alaska. And yesterday morning, I took a truck coming down from my village on an ice road. And it was 20 below. And I hated to leave and get down here to a 60, 70 degree weather. And I'm suffering. I have a right to be cold. Thank you very much for inviting me, and of course, English language is my second language, and I really appreciate the discussions on sea level rise, and I really appreciate the depth of discussions, and all of those previous indigenous presenters talked about what I was going to say. But anyway, I really appreciate the experiences throughout the indigenous nations. And in Alaska, I want to tell a little story in very few minutes so we can have questions and answers. And I just, again, really appreciate you know, telling stories, and as a Yupak person, and listening to stories, 15 minutes isn't enough. And I just, you know, as a Yupak person, we're not real time conscious, but we like to, you know, listen to my grandmother telling these stories 4 hours, but 15 minutes, I guess, can do the impact. As my wife, who is a teacher, said, "Mike, you got to keep it down to 15 minutes, and you can make sure that there is retention." I think we are impacted up there, and as Alaska's native peoples, we have relied on the lands and waters for our nutrition and traditional subsistence uses since time immemorial, and we heard that earlier. Yet climate change is wreaking havoc in Alaska. We are experiencing melting sea ice, rising oceans, rising river temperatures, thawing permafrost, severe erosion, and dying forests. Our animals are at rise, and as a consequence, so are our communities. Yet we are strong people and are taking creative steps to find a path forward. For the future of our children, we look to our elders for their wisdom and guidance. And I just came off the Iditarod Trail a few weeks ago, a 1,000-mile race across Alaska, and it was terribly warm. And we had to swim across the sloughs, and the dogs had to swim across the sloughs. And in my 15 Iditarods, it's getting more and more challenging to cut across Alaska every year, and seeing the changes that I'm seeing firsthand, and also in our communities where we live. The thinning of ice and our hunting and gathering is more challenging, and people are going through the ice, and those are things that we are witnessing. And I think Senator Biggage and our traditional chief. My uncle was a traditional chief of our Yipe people, but he has passed on. Paul John is an elder, and Senator Biggage is the one that is really in support of doing something about the impacts of climate change in our villages. And you just heard about one of the witnesses, young Nelson Canuck, and he was our witness, and he lives about 100 miles west from my village, and he has a wonderful story to tell, and he is one of the young men that is taken on through a legal challenge about his existence and his village. So Nelson is served as a witness along with our friend here from Hawaii and two other witnesses. I think Alaska is surrounded by all of the water, and we have 6,600 miles, which is constantly changing due to wave action, ocean current, storms, and river deposits. Alaska encompasses 365 million acres with permafrost found over approximately 80% of the state. And there are 229 federally recognized tribes living throughout Alaska, and I'm from the West Coast, there are going to be about 180 communities that are going to be dealing with being underwater in 50 years, in a very short period of time, and especially in my area, in West Coast, which one of my villages is slated. It's already in middle of the river, but it has sunk into the river already, but we're having to keep moving back. A typical Alaska Native village has infrastructure, and many of our communities still live in third world conditions. And this is Kivalina, a small village that has filed a suit because look at the community, and it's vulnerable. And storms have hit the community, and there was no running water this winter in the schools, and they had to melt ice to drink water. So this is one of the villages that are looking to move in Alaska, and I think we're going to be looking. We're going to we're going to have to live with the changes, and we're fighting for our survival up there. And you know, with the whaling and with the drying of fish, we had more challenges in drying fish in the past few years because of unpredictable warm storms, and it has been wet, our villages have really impacted by the change that we are seeing, and many of the fish drying has really, you know, they spoiled, and my dogs are happy, but you know, we are sort of dried fish for our survival right now. And this is my community, and we have about 350 people there, and we depend on salmon and moose and other species, caribou in Western Alaska, and we were the regional hub in the area. When illnesses hit us, we had a hospital there, and a lot of people died and were buried in the community. And this is my dog yard. The village is used to be down in the river, and the old village sites has completely fallen to the river already. And those are my puppies, and they are my Hawaiian puppies. That white dog, his name is Wahine, and that pup on your left is Hapa. And I had a Hawaiian handler that named these puppies, but they did well on the latter Iditarod runs. The community right now, we're bracing up for another flood, and we've had disasters of floods in the past, and the tanks are gone right there. All of that land has eroded, and those tanks have been moved away. So there, those oil tanks are gone. And this used to be where the cemetery, the human remains were there, the people that came, and there were huge amount of deaths occurring in our community, and there were hundreds of people buried, and that has began falling into the river, and it took an entire summer for all of our young people working together to move the cemetery. And as a counselor, I had to deal with the issues of breakouts and depression, and when those workers were moving the human remains every day throughout the summer, and they were working like 15 to 18 hours a day and moving those human remains. And this is my smokehouse, and I had to move it. This is the third time, and it's already after this fall storm. This smokehouse need to be moved, and it's just really terrible. And there are more stories in Alaska, and New Talk is currently being moved right now, and I just spoke with the tribal administrator there. They are moving the village piece by piece, but there's political issues, and people lived there for many, many years, and they grew up and were born in the village of Newtok. But those elders hate to move to a new location because of the traditional areas, and they're attached to that, but they have no other choice but to move. Kivalina, you've seen that, is in process of looking at different places to move, and Shishmaref is also looking at different areas to move. So we're also, Akiak, where I'm from, we're also looking to move soon. And again, 180 communities are in jeopardy of, and the GAO did a research, and it would cost each community somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million to $400 million to move. And who is willing to pay for it? Nobody is willing to pay for that. But for the most part, the land is also in question because, you know, the state and federal has selected lands, and the native corporation lands have selected, and nobody wants to give up land. And where do we move? It's a big question, and it's a huge political challenge to deal with those issues. So in Hawaii, you know, we've heard stories. Lastly, asserting native resilience. It was done by Zoltan Grossman and Alan Parker from Evergreen State College. And Pacific Rim indigenous nations face the climate crisis. And it has been forwarded by Billy Frank and the story I have in there is what I testified in Congress with Representative Markey's Committee on Global Warming, and that is affecting the vulnerable communities throughout the Pacific and throughout Alaska and throughout this nation. Again, thank you for inviting me, and we're going to be around, and contact us any time during the year. And again, thanks for inviting me again, and I feel like, you know, we need more time for discussions, in-depth discussions, and hopefully the next 15 minutes will do it, but if not, then get our emails and our phone numbers, and I'll be willing to talk to you more in depth. Thank you very much for it. I broke my glasses this morning. There was a lady from United Kingdom that punched me. No, I adjusted them and I broke. Thank you.
So I've been back there taking notes. There are so many things I'd like to ask. And the way that I wanted to do it is I wanted to present it to the whole panel so that they could discuss amongst themselves and either find solutions or just tell us a story that will inspire or enlighten us or educate us. And then what we're going to do is open up the floor so that one or two, is about all the time we may have, will ask a question to either all the panel or any member of the panel that you'd like to hear a little bit more from. I heard a long time ago from an elder that freedom is an inside job. And as we all know by these amazing people, we know, learning once again, the extreme threat of climate change and how severe the situation is to us as human beings, the sea level rise, that these are actually issues that touch upon human rights. And if freedom is an inside job, no one, especially Native peoples, we begin to realize that if we don't do it, if we don't push the envelope, that often things do not get done. And like someone said, that we are the litmus test. We are the canary in the mine. But often, because we are Native people, we are the last people that oftentimes people want to listen to. And we should be the first, because we were right there on the front lines and have this particular relationship with certain bioregions. So hope I can say this right, because it's like a big question. I believe that how we think shapes our reality. And I heard you say some of those things. Mike also, as we were talking down there. Roberta, I know for years. You know, and so I guess my question to all of you is, how do we address our communities? I mean, really practical, the people we live in with, the people we see every day, our young people, our old people. How do we, because many, they know what's going on, but they don't really, are not either accepting it, they're hoping things are going to get better, you know, those kinds of things. So how do we communicate the severity of where we are in regards to climate change and sea level rise within our own people? And then, because of what Ben said, how do we then begin to reach out globally? No, that's a big question, but it's something we have to do every day. I don't know.
Well, I think we heard the stories in Squamish, you know, what the people in Squamish in the Northwest are doing. And in my community, we were hit by severe storms and erosion. And we've been meeting as a community, how can we mitigate, how can we adapt to these challenges? And we felt like we want to tell our stories. And that First Stewards meeting last summer, I think, accomplished some of that contact with federal agencies and our policymakers, the representatives and senators that were involved, along with the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. And you know, the administration and federal and state managers need to hear our stories, and I think First Stewards meeting accomplished some of that awareness, and I think we're bracing up for another First Stewards to this coming fall in Washington, D.C., and to begin to tell our stories, not only telling these stories, but to urge them, to urge Congress and administration to take this as a priority. And I believe with the new Secretary of State and other policymakers that have brought this issue of global warming and climate change up, you know, we have a chance right now, and we have a window of opportunity, and that small window of opportunity is upon us, and we need to take action.
Yes.
In my community, it's a little different. There's actually only small changes, and we're so busy trying to restore our knowledge, our traditional knowledges, you know, and going back into the chants and our stories. And a lot of it was recorded in the Hawaiian language newspapers. Over about 100 years of information has been recorded. They being the elders, felt it was, well, wrote with a sense of urgency to try and record everything. So the Hawaiian community is really busy with trying to restore that knowledge again, yes, and to understand it, and then and on top of that, try and bridge it to today. You know, how can we utilize that information for today in a contemporary world? Yes. And so for us, we notice things like our winters come later. Small change, not a big change. We've noticed that some of our migratory birds that fly to Alaska or Russia are deciding not to and are staying. The whales have been coming later and leaving earlier. So it's like really tiny, small changes like that that's occurring, that if you are not knowledgeable in what the natural cycles have been over time, you wouldn't notice. So therefore, it's for my community itself, it's not really important right now because they don't see the big changes. Mm-hmm. So, and tacking on to what Mike said earlier, I think it was at that symposium where we heard stories from everyone else's communities that it became real. And the issue of ocean acidification became real. You know, sea level rising became real. Permafrost disappearing where the tundra is just a marsh is real. I'm looking at real people being impacted by that. And I think that's really probably the active way of how we can, you know, bridge that across. And watching Ben's presentation this morning only made it... you know, it's who's got the big gun versus who's got the voice and who's being impacted. Wow, I was blown away by that. And even in Hawaii, there is a movement for Idle No More as well. Yes. So, yes. You know, it's an active movement. So, anyway.
Great. Good.
You know, what she said? Yeah, what she said. We have a lot of the same phenomena here. Having to do with trying to revitalize our understanding of our culture, and you saw some of the examples of that in the slides that I showed you. And so I think that probably the main threat to us as a people, the Chumash peoples, is that most of us have become separated from our knowledge of the land and the ocean. Mm-hmm. And the things that we've been trying to do have been an attempt to bring us back to that. And without that connection, you don't have that passionate love for taking care, which mm-hmm. is still our obligation as indigenous peoples, yes, to take care whether or not we have access to those places. Okay. And at First Stewards also, I had that same experience of, you know, oh my God, this is so big and it's so right there. And I am personally struggling with how to bring that to my people here, you know, how we bring that here. Mm-hmm. Because so far the things that have been happening here and are measurable can be construed as being within the normal large cycles that we see here. And so they're not really felt that much or understood that much, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that probably the way of thinking that we need to engender the most and support the most is that we are all children of the same mother on this earth, and we need to connect with one another. We need to have compassion for our differences and embrace those differences as well, so that we can work together. We absolutely have to work together.
Mm-hmm. You know, Orrin Lyons once said that one thing that indigenous people who have lived in a particular area for thousands of years is that we have this long trajectory of history that we can actually almost look back and see centuries of stories of living on a particular, I'll call it a bioregion, your particular homeland. And with that comes this incredible knowledge that a lot of our young people have forgotten. But what we say in our communities, and I don't know about you guys, that it's not lost and it's not dead. It's just sleeping. And so it is up to us to awaken that. And I am so happy to hear that the First Stewards Gathering did that for all of you. And then there's the imperative that we got to get out there and do something. It's like, here, you can't just, you've got all this knowledge and you can't just sit there and not do anything. It's almost like you are called to do something. Are there any people out there who have questions? Because I
I was just, my mind was just swirling out there with different ideas. Yes, I see two people here. There's one woman in the front and someone way in the back.
Someone over there.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Mr. Williams, we know that a lot of Alaska villages have already had to make a lot of moves, adjust, and so on. And I'm wondering if anybody has helped you with either planning or money to get those moves made.
Yeah, with a village of New Talk and with in communicating with him, I think some of the federal agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, have limitations of what they can do in terms of moving, and we have, you know, housing and other health agencies that have that capacity, but it has been like piecemealing. You know, each, you know, if they're going to make a house, then they're building two houses, or, you know, moving the water plant. And you know, I think there needs to be a contemporary planning, I think, to move these communities, and I think the federal government and the congressional folks need to take action to help these communities to deal with the infrastructure. And I think it's the federal government has a trust obligation to the tribes of this nation, and you know, for the most part, you know, in the budgeting process, we pay big time for it, you know, the cuts, and while our people are suffering with health care and housing issues and infrastructure, clean water to drink, and, you know, we're, you know, still live in third world conditions in Alaska, and our people are continuously dying, and but I think the federal agencies need to coordinate better, and I think with the First Stewards holding big meetings like that in the community of DC and where all the resources are, I think you know, we can begin to make impact and change some of those minds that are naysayers in Congress that deny, they are still in denial. And as a counselor, you know, when there is a problem, then we don't have a problem. And I'm dealing with denial all the time as a wellness counselor.
But Mike, and as they're starting to plan to maybe move the people, are they able to stay fairly close to their original homeland, or do they have to be moved far away?
Yes, I think with the village of New Talk, they're moving 10 miles, at least 10 miles away inland, but that's still far away from where they were born. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, with the events like salmon are disappearing, you know, we've you know, we have a trial getting started for next week. There's 22 fishermen that decide to go fishing because we were hungry last summer. Mm. We weren't allowed to fish for 7 days. So our elder said, go fishing because we're hungry. Mm. And then we went out fishing and were arrested for fishing to feed our families. So we're going to have a two-week trial, which some of them were already convicted of fishing during the time when it was closed. But our elders said go fishing. And, you know, I think our resources are being affected as well with the impact of ocean acidification or other impacts that are happening inland.
There was another hand way back there and then over here. So did our... Now that was our next one back there.
Hello. I'm a marine biologist and a professor at Antioch University in Santa Barbara, and I just started a program about environmental justice and advocacy. And I teach a lot of classes about climate refugees and UN policies. And my students are now asking me questions that I don't have the answers to. And one of them is, a lot of these, you know, indigenous groups are affected more by climate change than other groups. And they're not the ones that are, you know, putting all the carbon in the atmosphere. And they're not even the ones that are affecting this change, but their lives are changing. And how do we collaborate with indigenous groups and keep in mind, you know, being sensitive to cultural differences and social justice type issues? Does that make sense?
Oh, that's a tough one.
That's a good question.
I guess that's why we're here. They're all pointing at me like I have the answer. You know, 15 minutes is really hard to get everything in there. Okay, to answer your question. You know, a lot of us need time just to even think about it, indigenous people. So, and we're not allowed that time to actually sit down and talk about it and think about it in our own frame of thinking and how we can actually answer some of these questions or attack some of these problems. It's imminent. It's going to happen. And you know, I'm searching for, like, really good words to say, you know. I think dialogue is great. And I think the ability to get together and talk to one another about it is important. And then you don't know who you're going to spark. You know, that in our culture, that's just the way it goes. You just bring everybody together, and you don't know who is going to be the one that has that passion, that spark, because with that passion comes the drive and the unbelievable, incredible amounts of, you know, emotion that'll make it happen. And that's kind of where I think we're at, so I don't really have an answer. Maybe others so, might.
Well, I would just like to say something about how you approach Native peoples. If wanting to work with them, I think it's really commendable that you're wanting to do this. And it's also very important to follow their lead in when you do that. But then in making the bridges, I think it can be very difficult because everybody carries stereotypes. You know, I mean, we just do. That's part of the human condition. But to, as much as possible, put aside your assumptions about what that's going to be like. We're just people. You know, we're just people. And we fight and we argue and we have fun and just like everybody else. So, but we do it differently. and we do it the same. So, you know, I think that probably the most important thing is that I do a lot of conflict management training, and one of the tools that I use is to talk about what we call the heavy metal rules. One of them is the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do to you, which many systems of thought and religions carry as a very important premise, and it is important. But that rule, the secret to using or to opening up from that is to know that assumes similarities. Mm-hmm. Okay, it assumes similarities. I mean, we want to go down, I won't go through the whole thing, but you want to change that when you are trying to make intercultural connections into what we call the platinum rule, and that's do to others as they would have you do to them. How do you know that? Dialogue, yeah. You know, so, but to put aside your assumptions and just talk.
Mm-hmm. And go back to that old idea, too, that when you mentioned social justice, that no human being is an island, no one stands alone, that whatever we do for one another. Sorry, Mike.
Yeah, I just, you know, that's a good question. And I think Ben, for the most part, you know, brought those out. And I just... really feel that as tribal peoples have managed our lands and our waters for thousands of years, and we have that track record. And for the most part, seems to me the reason why people are starting to stand up and protest is because our voices are not being heard. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the answers, the traditional ecological knowledge that we possess in our elders, are not engaged in those preparations. For instance, when oil development is going to occur, the industries or development of our resources are going to be occurring. Where are the tribes? The tribes are not there in weighing in an environmental impact process. You know, health assessments and impact assessments are not taken in under consideration. But I think the tribe, there's state governments, there's tribal governments, and there's federal government, and there's industry. And I think where the tribes, there's over 100 tribes here in California, there's over 200 tribes in Alaska, and there's more tribal governments, and they need to be on the table mm-hmm. before anything occurs and before we pay big time for it. So.
I think we have one more question. No more questions. But we'll be around, so we can visit.
Thank you, Margaret. I'm so glad you came.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.